Hey there, I'm Sean Finnegan, and you are listening to Restitutio, a podcast that seeks to recover authentic Christianity and live it out today. Today we're beginning something new. I've been working on this class on 1 Corinthians for months and months. Now, I had taken classes on 1 Corinthians at Boston University twice, in fact. The first time, we just read through the entire epistle in Greek. And the second time, the next semester, was when we learned about what modern scholars say about Corinth. I've also taught this epistle in the past, both in a home Bible study in Rhode Island and at the college level in Georgia. Then last April, I had the opportunity to visit many ancient sites in both Turkey and Greece, including Corinth, which gave me firsthand knowledge and experience with the site and the museum. Of course, I took tons of pictures as well. Then we hiked up the Acrocorinth to get a good view of the ocean and the ancient site. From all this, I've put together a class on 1 Corinthians that I hope will make the Bible come alive for you in a new and exciting way. Now, when most people pick up their Bibles and read 1 Corinthians, they approach it as if this was a modern document addressing our concerns today. Of course, there is a lot in 1 Corinthians that directly applies to us today. But there's also a huge potential for misunderstanding when we read today's issues and categories into Scripture. A better approach, and the approach I'll be taking in this class, is to do the hard work of adjusting our minds to think like they thought in their time and place. When we do that, we can see through their eyes, and this will tremendously help us to understand what Paul was doing in the epistle he wrote them. Today is an introduction to the city of Corinth to help you start getting your bearings. Then, next week, we'll look at what happened when Paul came there. Here now is episode 584, 1 Corinthians in Context, Part 1, Corinth as the Context. Welcome to the 1 Corinthians in Context class. I'm so glad that you're all here with me tonight. I'm really excited about this class. I have been researching it and studying it a lot over the past months, and I'm excited to share what I've learned. 1 Corinthians is easily the most revealing window into how Christianity clashed with Roman urban culture. We may not think of it much, but Jesus operated mostly in the countryside and with farmers and fishers and people that were in Galilee in particular. He did make some trips to the big city, to Jerusalem. But when it comes to 1 Corinthians, we're talking about urban Christians, Christians that are active in an urban environment. They're going to have all this conflict with the standard ways of thinking and approaching things that the Romans do in the Roman Empire. So, not only do we learn how the gospel challenged worldly wisdom and assumptions, we also see how Paul reasoned and engaged with complex moral issues. The ancient world, especially in a city like Corinth, even 2,000 years ago, was not simple. It was complex, there was a lot going on, and so that's good for us because our world is also complex with a lot going on. And so by seeing how the Apostle Paul engaged with their issues and handled them, we can get a good guide to deal with our issues. When we are thinking of recent innovations like technology, sexuality, gender, morality, we have all kinds of innovations happening all the time. How do we handle that as Christians? What should we do? How should we think? This book, I think, can really help us with that. In this class, we'll answer questions like, why were the Corinthians so into speaking in tongues? Why was there such tolerance for sexual immorality? What's the deal with food sacrificed to idols? What was the Christian position on same-sex couples? Why were they so divided into factions? To answer questions like these, we're going to set 1 Corinthians in its original historical context. And so our objectives for this class are, one, to become familiar with life in first century Corinth. Two, to reconstruct what was happening in the church at Corinth. Three, to see how 1 Corinthians made sense to its original recipients. And then four, to apply 1 Corinthians to our context today. Now, we're not going to go through every verse. If we were to do that, it would take a very long time because it's a fairly long book, 16 chapters. It would just take a lot of time. Instead of turning over every stone or giving you my take on every sentence in the book, we're going to have more of a modest goal. I want to equip you with the information you need to understand for yourself when you read 1 Corinthians after this class is done. That's really my target, is to give you the information you need so that when you're reading it on your own, you're like, oh yeah, that makes more sense to me now, whereas before you just didn't even notice something that was important, or maybe you thought something was there that's really not there because of just missing a cultural fact of some sort. The goal is not just to fill your head with my opinions, but to empower you to develop your own. Here's the official description for this class. 1 Corinthians is easily the most revealing letter Paul wrote to any of the churches. Reading it, we find a church riddled with strife, sinfulness, and doctrinal error. Rather than reading 1 Corinthians as if it were written today, we'll read it in its original context. Doing so, we'll reconstruct the various situations to see how Paul addressed them. Then we'll be in good shape to apply the truths, instructions, and warnings to ourselves today. My prayer is that this class will make the Bible come alive for you in a new and exciting way that will not only educate you, but also challenge you to live out your faith authentically. Okay, so I've been using this word context a lot. What do I mean by context? I mean a lot of things. Geography, history, politics, economics, quality of life, technology, religion, housing, morality, society, culture. I mean, what was it like for those people who lived then, in that place, at that time? That's what I mean. How do we find out the context of reading 1 Corinthians? Well, you can go there. You can visit Corinth. Even to this, you can get on a plane tonight, you'd be there tomorrow morning. Then you would have firsthand eyewitness information about Corinth. And it's actually pretty useful to do that. Also, you can look at pictures. That's a much less expensive way to do it. Look at pictures taken by others, or even these days we have drone footage, which is really, really cool. I was watching a drone video on YouTube trying to find just like the perfect shot, what I really wanted. And the guy had the drone do like every angle except for the one I wanted. It was the most frustrating 2 minutes of my life. But the music was epic, so I guess it was worth it. So yeah, you could visit Corinth, you could look at pictures, you could look at maps. Maps are really helpful. I'm going to show you some maps tonight. We also have archaeology. Archaeologists have excavated a lot of Corinth, and so we know a lot about the buildings over different periods of time. And part of that archaeology is inscriptions. Inscriptions are anything written that has survived. And we have lots of inscriptions from Corinth that have survived. I have some pictures of some that I will be sharing with you, but then the professionals take pictures of these things when they first dig them out of the ground, thankfully, so that, you know, if something gets weathered or lost or whatever happens, like, you at least have a really good picture. So we have good information on that. We also have coins. Coins survive, and the coins from Corinth are in like really good shape, especially some of the gold coins. Like, they're gorgeous, and you can see very clearly who's on the coin and what it's talking about, and like some of their symbols and stuff. And guess what? It's not George Washington and an eagle. Big surprise, right? Their coins are different. And then last of all, we have ancient literary sources. I break these into two categories. We have Christian literary sources. So for example, the book of Acts, especially chapter 18, we're going to look at this next time. Acts chapter 18 talks about Paul going to Corinth originally and starting the church. So that's super helpful for understanding 1 Corinthians. 1 Corinthians itself, obviously, is a Christian literary source that we're going to use. 2 Corinthians as well. And Romans 16, I believe that Romans was written from Corinth. And in the last chapter of Romans, you get shout-outs, greetings sent from people that are there to the church at Rome. And the people who happen to be there are Corinthian people. So we get a little bit of information about the Corinthian church from Romans 16. And then 1 Clement. 1 Clement is a document not in our Bibles, but it's very early, maybe around the year 90 AD, give or take. And so this is a letter written by a guy named Clement to the church at Corinth. It's not biblical, but it is a Christian document, and it does have some information that's a little bit helpful. Then, outside the Christian literary sources, we have other ancient literary sources. And between you and me, I'd rather listen to some ancient person than to a modern person, because an ancient person is in a better position to know what they're talking about because they lived in that same world. They actually could go to Corinth in the first century, whereas like modern people, so far as I know, we still don't have time machines. So like they're just depending on these other ancient literary sources as well. And there are a lot. It might surprise you to know that so much of the literature of the ancient world has survived to today. And so we have, I'm just going to rattle through this list quickly here, but we have Pausanias, Antipater of Sidon, Polystratus, Cicero, Carnagoras, Diodorus Siculus, Strabo, Livy, Propertius, Vitruvius, Philo, Petronius, Pliny the Elder, Epictetus, Josephus, Martial, Pseudo-Julian, Dio-Chrysostom, Plutarch, Juvenal, Pliny the Younger, Suetonius, Appian, Florus, Aelius Aristides, Lucian, Apuleius, Gellius, Lysiphron, Cassius Dio, Philostratus, and Athenaeus. 32 sources, 32 ancient sources that talk about Corinth, either specifically the century before Paul got there, the century when Paul was there, or the century after Paul was there. Okay, so like that full range of like three centuries. All of these sources has something to say about them. I have read everything they have written that relates to the city of Corinth. I've taken notes on anything that I thought would be useful for this class. And so I'm going to be sprinkling in quotations from these ancient authors. None of these are Christians. A couple of them are Jewish. For example, Philo and Flavius Josephus are both Jewish. Some of them are Greek, some of them are Roman, but they're not part of the Bible, they're not part of Christianity, but they just tell us about the city, and even more importantly, about the people who lived in the city. Now, before you get too impressed with me, I want to come clean that I encountered all 32 of these sources in this one book by Jerome Murphy O'Connor called St. Paul's Corinth. So if you want to do your own research and just like get all the quotes, it's actually very easy to get to in this volume that he put together some time ago. All right, so for example, let's start with a quote from Pliny the Elder. Pliny the Elder died in the eruption of Mount Vesuvius in the year 79. I always feel such a connection to Brother Pliny because I was born in 79 and he died in 79, but you know, it's just 1900 years apart. But anyhow, Pliny the Elder said the following. He said, "The inlets on either side are called the Gulf of Corinth and the Saronic Gulf." He's talking about Corinth, the city. This is a first century person who had been there in the first century. So he says there's two gulfs, the Gulf of Corinth, the Saronic Gulf, the former ending at Lechium and the latter in Cenchreae. The circuit of the Peloponnese is a long and dangerous voyage for vessels prohibited by their size from being carried across the isthmus on trolleys, and consequently successive attempts were made by King Demetrius, Caesar the dictator, and the emperors Caligula and Nero to dig a ship canal through the narrow part, an undertaking which the end that befell them all proves to have been an act of sacrilege. In the middle of this neck of land, which we have called the Isthmus, is the colony of Corinth, the former name of which was Ephyra. Its habitations cling to the side of a hill, 7.5 miles from the coast on either side, and the top of its citadel, called Acrocorinth, on which is the spring of Pirene, commands views of the two seas in opposite directions. There is so much in this quote. Like he just used words to say all the things that I want you to be able to picture in your mind. I realize this is like a very fast go-through, so let's take a moment to unpack it. So first off, let's look at the map. Corinth exists in the midst of the Mediterranean world at a time when the Roman Empire ruled this whole region around the Mediterranean world. Corinth is in Greece. This is Greece over here, and Corinth is right about there, okay? So what else is around? Well, we've got Italy, and then over here to the east of Greece, you have what they called Asia. It's not what we call Asia. What we call Asia is way over farther east than this. We call it Turkey, and they called it Asia. But the western part of what we call Turkey is the place they call Asia, or sometimes called Asia Minor. Here's Judea and Galilee, and the land that used to be known as Israel at the time. Now it was known by these different names, Judea, Samaria, and Galilee. And then right above it is Syria. Down here we have Egypt in the south. It was a big world, but it was a connected world. How was it connected? Roads and the ocean. And they didn't have trains, they didn't have cars, you know, but you had roads so you could walk, you could ride a horse, and you had a lot of ships navigating. In particular, one of the things that would happen is, you see how it's nice and green down here in northern Egypt? There's a city up there called Alexandria. Egypt was considered to be the breadbasket of the Roman Empire. And so ships were regularly going from Egypt all the way to the city of Rome on the west coast of Italy. That was a standard thing that happened. That's not an easy trip. For ancient people that don't have GPS, don't have a lot of our modern benefits, this takes serious skill, and they did it all the time. They had the skill. All right, let's look at another map here. In this case, I've zoomed in a little bit on Greece. Maybe you could start to see a little bit more definition. What's the big thing that sticks out to you? Islands. There's just so many islands. It's crazy how many islands there are. There are islands everywhere. Navigating by ship is actually can be dangerous because of islands, but it also can be helpful because of islands, because they can serve as visual markers for you to navigate across the Aegean Sea or the Ionian Sea. So this one over here, this on the east is the Aegean Sea, and this is the Ionian Sea over here. And Corinth is right in between the two of them. So this mass right here is called the Peloponnesian Peninsula. It's a great double P name for a place, right? We just call it the Peloponnese typically. You can see the Peloponnese Peninsula is not attached in the north. This right here, this is not an attachment. If you zoom in far enough, you'll see there's ocean there. In modern times, there's a bridge. In ancient times, there's no bridge, okay? So it's not attached there. Where is it attached? It's attached by this isthmus right here. And on the skinny part of the isthmus is where you have Corinth. So if you're a ship that is going from Rome to Ephesus, guess what? That would be a tremendous shortcut to take, because you could come through here, and then if you could get your stuff to the other side, Ephesus is right over there. Otherwise, what do you have to do? You've got to go all the way down here and then skip right through there and then come up this way. 6 days difference in travel. You could cut 6 days off if you went through the isthmus. So what they would do is they would go to the isthmus, unload the boat, transport the cargo, and then put it in a different boat waiting on the other side, and they would go to the next place. So I just want to say a word about the Cape down. So this right here, this little spot right there is called Cape Malea. And it is a very dangerous place many times of the year to navigate by ship. In fact, as old as Homer's Odyssey, Odysseus said, "And now all unscathed should I have reached my native land, but the wave and the current of the north wind beat me back as I was rounding Malea and drove me from my course past Cythera." Cythera is this island right here. So he was trying to go around the Cape, and the wind was against him, and that's what sets up the whole story of the Odyssey. That's why he goes on an Odyssey. That's why he's on an adventure, because he didn't get home, because it's so hard to round the Cape at the bottom of the Peloponnese. Strabo relates a proverb. He says, "But when you double Malea, forget your home. Double means you've gone around one side and now you're going around the second side of it, so you're seeing it twice as long. Rather than just going past it, you're actually making the turn and trying to go around it. He said, just forget your home. Like, it's just suicide, buddy. Like, don't even try it. Now, people did it, but it was dangerous, and it took six more days. So that all plays into what we're talking about here. Now I'm zooming in a little bit more, and now we can see a little more clearly the two gulfs on either side of the isthmus. So on this west side, we have the Corinthian Gulf right here, and on the east side, we have the Saronic Gulf. And then the part where the isthmus is narrowest is where they would transport everything across. Here is a panoramic taken by Jerry Weirwell of the west gulf there, which is the Corinthian Gulf, and then you have the land in between, and then to the east, you have the Saronic Gulf out in the distance. So you can see it is a narrow piece of land, 4 miles across at its narrowest. And you can see why Corinth would be the crossroads of the north and the south, because if you wanted to get from the mainland of Greece down to the Peloponnesian Peninsula by land, you had to go through that isthmus. And if Corinth is in the middle of that isthmus, then guess what? That's the city you stop at when you want to go and you want to spend the night, or you want to go and you want to buy supplies, or you want to go and you want to make a deal to sell some goods because it's got two ports. What city has two ports? That's so weird. Cities have one port, typically. This one has two ports to two seas. It is also the crossroads for the east and the west. Like I said before, if you want to get stuff from Italy out to Asia, then you've got to go through this isthmus. Now, the two harbors, Lechium on the west was a harbor that was man-made, and it was incredible. It was like one of the most impressive engineering feats. And then on the east, Kenkrei, the harbor is mostly still there, like you can see it. Even when you go, you can kind of see like the leftovers of where they had kind of mounded up the ground to break the waves, even though they're under the waves now. I have this really helpful description from Donald Engels in his book, Roman Corinth. He writes, "The man-made harbor, one of the largest in the Roman world, would be crowded with vessels from all over the Mediterranean. Its quays and warehouses would be packed with goods coming from as far as India, China, and even Indonesia. Spices, silks, precious stones, exotic woods, marble blocks of every color in the rainbow from Anatolia, North Africa, Italy, and producing areas of Greece, amphoras filled with wines, olive oils, and other vegetable oils, copper and tin ingots for the city's bronze foundries, and block of Corinth's own building stone for export." One of the main things I'm trying to do in this class is to train your imagination. I want you to see it. The only way to see it is to get a little bit detailed, okay? So I'm going to be getting a little bit detailed as we go, and I think that will be helpful. But I want you to imagine Corinth as a prosperous place because of merchants and business. If you want to ship something, you're going to go through Corinth if you can. And they use this wealth to beautify the city. And we know this from archaeology because they found all these huge buildings, and they're like, wow, how did they buy that? How did they pay for that? Well, it was all this money coming in. All right, so let's talk about the mechanics. How did the goods cross the isthmus? In the 7th century before Christ, a guy named Periander, the ruler of Corinth, wanted to dig a canal. So already 7 centuries before Christ, they're thinking to themselves, you know, if we could just dig a canal here, it would really be great. And so he attempted to do it, failed. Instead, he built an overland stone road that's called the Diolkos. Merchants could unload their boats and transport their cargo across it to another boat. In the year 44 BC, the emperor, well, not really emperor, but Pliny the Elder called him the dictator. And when Pliny the Elder calls him a dictator, he's not trying to be rude. Like, he actually had the title dictator conferred upon him by the Roman Senate because he was fighting wars, and you would assign somebody the title of dictator for 1 year to like just deal with military stuff that needed to be done. It's just that Julius Caesar didn't give it up after he was declared dictator. But anyhow, Julius Caesar in the year 44 BC planned to cut a canal through the isthmus, but was murdered. Then during the reign of Tiberius, from 14 to 37, he sent engineers who attempted to dig a canal, but couldn't make much progress. So instead they fashioned logs so that they could roll boats across the Diolkos. This is like the same way the Egyptians moved huge blocks to make their pyramids. You put logs and then you can roll across them. Eventually, they cut channels in the pavement to guide the wheels of trolleys. And these wheels are about 5 feet apart. The Diolkos was a major source of income for Corinth. Even though it didn't have a canal, it had a stone road. And guess what? Corinth is going to control that stone road and they're going to charge people for it. Makes sense, right? What do we call that today? A toll, right? Like toll booths, and you're on the highway and they charge, oh, you can't go over this bridge. That's $20. Oh, okay. Oh. Then we have Caligula. He reigned from 37 to 41. He really wanted to dig a canal too through the isthmus. And he sent a chief centurion to survey the work, but nothing came of it. Then in 67, Nero gave it another try. Suetonius, a historian, says, Nero took a mattock himself and at a trumpet blast broke the ground and carried off the first basket of earth on his back. So it was a ceremonial groundbreaking that Nero was involved with. Nero's general, a man named Vespasian, was out in the east conquering Galilee, putting down Jewish revolts, and he rounded up 6,000 of the strongest men in the city of Tiberias, which is in Galilee, captured them and brought them to the isthmus to dig the canal. So he took Jews and brought them over, who would now be slaves, and forced them to dig. They made it a half mile, and then Nero died suddenly, and his successor, Galba, didn't care about the project, so nobody kept building it. And that's the way it was for centuries. Like, basically, Pliny the Elder's attitude in the year 79 is the attitude everybody had for centuries and centuries. Actually, there was one guy who was saying, well, the Ionian Sea is a different level than the Aegean Sea, so if you dig a canal, it could just drown everybody, which is ridiculous. But like, that was another reason they had for not doing it. It wasn't until the year 1893, after 11 years of work, that Greece had won its independence from the Ottoman Empire and had this canal actually dug. And you can see from this satellite picture, the canal goes straight through the isthmus, which is pretty cool to see. They have lots of bridges over it. When you stand atop the bridge looking down on the modern canal from the 19th century, you're amazed by how steep the walls are and how they're solid stone, which is like, I wonder why the Roman emperors had such a hard time digging this thing. Like, you needed dynamite and modern excavation tools to do it. When I was there, I saw 4 sailboats making their way through it, but sadly, 19th century sized boats are not 21st century sized boats, and so like our modern, you know, big barges and stuff can't go through it, it's too narrow. But it did finally get done. Well, let's go back to the history of Corinth here. Let me just give a brief historical survey of how the city got started and stuff like that, and explain the difference between ancient Greek Corinth and then Roman Corinth, because they're very different, but they're also the same location, and there are some similarities. The ancient city is alleged to have been founded by Sisyphus. Now, if you don't know your Greek mythology very well, Sisyphus was so badly behaved that he was punished by the gods to roll a boulder up a hill, and then just as he's about to get it on top of the hill, it rolls back down, and then he has to go back down and get the boulder and roll it, and he just does that for all eternity. That's poor Sisyphus. Whether there was a historical Sisyphus is irrelevant. The fact is, by the time we're talking about by New Testament times, his name is associated with this city. And there's a little shrine to Sisyphus nearby. You know, people are just kind of telling that story about him. The city, however it was founded, eventually becomes a Greek city of great significance. I won't go into all the details of how it happened, but it rebelled against the Roman Empire. There really wasn't much of a Roman Empire yet, and it wanted its independence. It didn't want to be part of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire disagreed. They sent a guy named Mummius in the year 146 BC, and he conquered Corinth. He destroyed it. He destroyed the walls. He burned the city. He killed many of the men, and he captured the women and the children, making them slaves, taking them back to Rome. It lay mostly in ruins, though there were some surviving structures, and some minor population stayed there through the century when it was basically abandoned. So from 146 BC until 44 BC, there basically isn't even a Corinth on the map. It's done. It's destroyed. Before that, it was a legendary Greek city. And after that, it was a legendary Roman city, okay? But in the middle, there wasn't anything going on. In 44 BC, Julius Caesar decides to refound Corinth as a Roman colony. He calls it Colonia Laus Julia Corinthiensis, which translated means the renowned Julian colony of the Corinthians. This is important because Corinthian people love this guy. They love Julius Caesar. They love all the Julians. They love his relatives, people that he adopted, everybody associated with him. The people in Corinth at the time period we're talking about were big fans of the royal family, if we could put it that way. So Julius Caesar says, I want to found Corinth. He starts things in motion, and then he gets assassinated by his own Senate because he's a dictator. Yeah. You just kind of got to own it sometimes. Yet, the project goes forward. It does happen. The city does get refounded. That's in 44 BC. The first colonists were primarily freedmen and poor Romans seeking land along with some veterans. Freedmen were Greek slaves to Romans who had served their masters well and were set free and now had the business connection of their previous master. So it's called a patronage relationship or a benefactor, where now you can go do your own business, you're freed, but you can use my connections to get going. So from inscriptions and coins and literary sources, we know the names of a number of the Roman Corinth's elite, and they're overwhelmingly freedmen. We'll talk more about freedmen later, but these are businessmen. They know how to do things in Latin. They know how to do things in Greek. They know the West. They know the East. They're competent. They know trade. They buy in bulk. They sell. You know, these are the kind of people that really get started in Corinth. Here's a quote from Jerome Murphy O'Connor. He says, the first colonists would also have numbered slaves. And of course, freemen willing to gamble on the advantages of being in on the ground floor of an enterprise which promised great rewards. Once the new colony grew, it would have attracted far-sighted entrepreneurs from both Greece and from the major trading countries in the Eastern Mediterranean, notably Egypt. Such infusions of new capital in a prime commercial situation inevitably generated more wealth, and within 50 years of its foundation, many of the citizens had become men of very considerable means. In order to gain capital, however, many of the first settlers turned to grave robbing. There was a ready market in Rome for Corinthian artifacts in terracotta and bronze, and the graves had not been looted by the army of Mummius. Interest in terracotta soon waned, but desire for bronze waxed. Well into the first century AD, the avidity with which collectors sought Corinthian bronze could be termed a mania by Pliny the Elder. There's a lot there. I'm not going to unpack it all. We're going to come back to Corinthian bronze later. I just want to make one quick distinction, which is there's a big difference between a freeman and a freedman. Freemen, free people, we would just say free people. They would say men, referring to men and women. It's an old English thing. They're saying that these people were born free. Whereas with the freedmen, These are former slaves, and they will always be attached to the name of their previous slave owner. They will literally take that as a name. So their slave owner is going to be a Roman. It's going to be a Latin name. And you can hear the difference. Like Greek and Italian people know the difference. Okay, so when they look at the inscriptions, they see Roman name, Greek name, and they're like, oh, freedman. This person had been a slave, and they took that name because the name was prestigious, and you pass the name down, like Flavius Josephus. Flavius wasn't his birth name. He took that name on because of his patron. So that's how it goes. Colonists received plots inside and outside of Corinth. Those they received outside were for farming. Those for inside were for living. They instituted a Roman government with Roman institutions. Latin was the official language. According to John Kent, there are 104 inscriptions from the first century that have been found in Corinth. 101 of them are in Latin. 3 are in Greek. What does that tell you? It tells you that the important people who make decisions on what gets carved into stone, what letters get carved in, they're overwhelmingly saying, we are a Roman colony. Not all cities were Roman colonies. Most cities were not Roman colonies. Corinth was a Roman colony. So they're going to have Latin as their official language, which is super weird when you're in the middle of Greece. Just keep that in mind. And it only lasted for a little while, because in the second century, it's all Greek inscriptions again. You know, so it's just this little window when we're talking about when Paul visited that it has this Roman flavor to it. Although the graffiti, which is like what the common people are writing on the walls, like you go to a public bathroom, like in a gas station, you see graffiti, right? That's what I'm talking about. That's all Greek. There's no surprise that Paul wrote to Corinth, he wrote in Greek. Because that's really what the common person spoke, even though that the official governmental language was Latin. There are two kinds of people. There were the colonists who had civil rights and they could vote. And then there were resident aliens. And everyone's trying to get their start in the beginning. It's like the rush to the West, the gold rush. You know, everyone's like, oh, I'm going to go get my plot of land. You know, it's like that in the beginning in 44. But then over time, they develop a system of government that is patterned on the city of Rome, and they have these different positions. You can be, if you were a wealthy noble person, you were called a decurio, and somebody of decurial rank could hold public office. If you weren't wealthy, you could not run for a public office, because the only people fit to be in public office were people that were going to spend big money on the city. Why would they want anyone else? You don't get paid big. You spend big if you get elected in the ancient world. Each year, Corinth voted in 2 men to be aediles, and they maintain streets and public works and marketplace. And there were also 2 men called the duoviers, and they were like the ultimate authority in the city. Maybe we would call it a mayor, something like that. Okay. In 27 BC, Augustus, who's the first Roman emperor, formed the province of Achaia and made Corinth the capital of that province. The colonists began huge building projects, including many temples and 2 major marketplaces, which are called forums, not agoras. In a Greek city, we would call it an agora or an agora, right? But in a Roman city, we call it a forum. So we call these forums, and they are very intentionally the Roman way of building a marketplace, not the Greek way of doing it. There are 2 major temples flanking the forum on the west and the north. We'll talk more about temples later. I'm just going to throw out a few names real quick. Poseidon was a big deal in Corinth. Why Poseidon? He's the god of the seas. You have 2 gulfs on either side of Corinth. Obviously, this place is blessed by Poseidon. That's what they would say. They loved Aphrodite. She's on so many of their coins. And they loved Asclepius. He's a god of healing, and he has a temple in the city itself. And then there are lots of other gods too. Apollo, this is actually a shot on the slide here of the Apollo temple. The Apollo temple was 6 centuries old when Paul got there. So it was already 6.5 centuries old when he got there. It's incredible how old this stuff is. Corinth had many fountains and lots of good water. I'll talk about more of this later, but there was like a mountain nearby. I say like a mountain because it just sort of like pfft, comes out of nowhere. It's not like our mountains where, you know, you kind of work up to it. It's just like, pfft, look at that, a mountain. And so water came down from the Acro Corinth, which is what you call that mountain. the city had really great water, which is, if you want to have a big city, you need lots of good water. The wall of Corinth had a circumference of 6 miles, which is 2.5 times the size of Athens at the time. Athens trash talks Corinth. Corinth trash talks Athens. Ancient Greek cities and Roman cities competed with each other all the time. By the time Paul got there, Corinth had surpassed Athens. Which is interesting because, like, Paul comes from Athens to Corinth. He doesn't stay in Athens. He's just, like, kind of weirded out by it. And, like, he makes a couple of converts and he's like, eh, whatever. And then he gets to Corinth and he's like, I'm staying. This is amazing. I'm staying here for 18 months, right? So Corinth was a much bigger deal than people realize. And it had a theater that could seat 14,000 people, recently renovated by the time Paul got there. And Corinth was an international port city, had been rapidly growing, lots of visitors, but also a stable population. Ben Witherington III estimates 50,000. Paul Gardner estimates 100,000. Nobody really knows, just for the record. But like somewhere between probably 50 to 100,000 people, permanent inhabitants of Corinth when Paul visited. So this is the context for the epistle to the Corinthians. This is that city. These are those people. Corinthians was written in the 50s. 1 Corinthians was written in the 50s and 2 Corinthians. So it's right in the center of this Roman period. It had been reestablished in the year 44 BC. Paul's going there in 51-ish, somewhere around there. So it had been in existence almost a century. All those freedmen and everything, all that stuff has already happened. It's grown. You have lots of international flavor, lots of people from diverse backgrounds. It's a bustling port city. And we're going to learn about what kind of people were in Corinth, what kind of religious practices they had, how the city government functioned a little more. We'll look at the philosophical schools that were present, how status functioned, and much more. Our approach is not to go verse by verse, like I already said, but instead we're just going to cover themes. And as often as I can, I'm going to bring out historical information that I think will be helpful for you to understand it as it was in that time, rather than as 21st century Americans or wherever it is you live, if you're watching this online. This way, when you go to read 1 Corinthians next time, you'll be able to understand it much better on your own. But first, we need to do business with how Corinth got founded. How did there end up being a church there? And we'll do that in our next session as we look at how Paul founded the church at Corinth.
Well, that brings this first presentation to a close. What did you think? Come on over to restitutio.org and find episode 584, Corinth as the context, and leave your questions and feedback there. Now, in the YouTube version of this class, which is coming out a little earlier than the audio versions, of course, the audio versions are edited and very nice. But anyhow, on the YouTube version of this class, Bobby wrote in on the comments saying, I love the way you teach, Sean. You dive so deeply into the time the New Testament writers lived in, what was happening, why, what people thought about was happening, etc., that we literally feel as though we are there receiving the letter. God bless you, brother. Well, Bobby, that is the goal. So it's very gratifying to see that you are picking up what I'm putting down, because I want you to be able to read 1 Corinthians and understand it on your own like they did. And then to ask the question, and it is an important question to ask, what does this mean to me in my context today as well? I think that's an important question to ask. And in my experience, the more liberal-leaning scholars will tend to only focus on the past, and the more conservative-leaning scholars will only focus on the present. And I think we need to do both. But really, the bulk of the work is tuning our ears to hear the way they heard, and then also asking, what does this mean to us today? On our previous episode, 583, Not Alone Anymore, with Vaughn Madsen, someone named Ken wrote in on YouTube saying, another good one. Hey, Vaughn and you other New Zealand Unitarians, why don't you comment here on these videos? Attract attention by comments and likes. It's the cheapest missions work you will do. Yes, I know it's only YouTube, and Sean wants feedback on podcasts, but this is there in the public face for everyone to see. Well, Ken, that's a good point. Comments do help the algorithm put the video in front of more people, because if a video has lots of comments, then the system concludes it is an interesting video and it will put it before more people and it will have a snowball effect. Also, the other thing that people can do is share. Whether you are listening to this on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, on YouTube, or whatever your app is that you use, most of these apps, if not all, have a share button. And if you find an episode in particular, something that you think other people would benefit from, please share. That's really the best way to support this podcast and help us to grow and reach more people. And then other ways you can support this podcast is through prayer. I could certainly use your prayer. And also those who want to make donations can do that on the website, restitutio.org. It's like the word restitution with no N, .org. And you can find the donate button there. Thanks to those who have. And as it turns out for this class, I did need to acquire a whole slew of new books, both digital and paper, both for primary sources and for secondary sources, ancient sources and modern sources, so that I could put this together. So thanks so much to those of you who have been supporting. It really does help a lot. Well, that's going to be it for this week. Stay tuned for next week. We'll get into Paul and looking at Acts chapter 18 and what it was like when he came to Corinth as we continue through this class. Thanks for listening, everyone. And remember, the truth has nothing to fear.